Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. Okay, we are in paper 55. We're still in section 3. Old single column, page number 626. On the old single column there, it's that second paragraph on that page. That's paragraph 13 in the section. It's the one that starts, "A planet the size of Urantia." Right before that little, that list there. Okay, so since we're right in the middle of the section, let's just remind ourselves briefly of what's happening in this section entitled The Golden Ages. As you reflect back on what we talked about last session, and that title, it shouldn't be surprising in retrospect that they talked about the things that they did. Because after all, you say to a human, the Golden Age, and all sorts of fanciful notions come to mind. Sort of just inescapably, you can't help it, you've been steeped in it your whole life. It goes back as far as there are stories in human history that we've fantasized about a golden age in the future or a golden age in the past or, what have you. So, we saw that, one of the things that they definitely wanted to do in that section is, make sure it was clear that even though we've just entered the first stage of light and life, there are many, many issues that we would never consider to be part of some golden age, in our fantasies. Many issues that are still definitively in play. And we're already talking about disease and, senility and all these sorts of things. So all of those ideas that, all of those basic material issues would be completely gone by that time. No, they're not completely gone yet. I mean, they're obviously a lot of what, we literally think of in terms of disease and stuff is in the past, but there's a lot of complexity to the human body, and there's a lot of issues that never get a chance to really manifest when all of the really coarse things are in play. You get rid of all the coarse things and all the fine things then start to show up. So it's a long process. And then, remember, it was even really striking, and they said, remember, never fear, but that even such glorified spheres present plenty of evil. So even, if you've managed to get yourself accepting the material issues, it's not just those issues. Because remember, like I mentioned when we read that, you're not going to wake up in the first mansion world in a sphere without evil, right? It isn't that fairy tale heaven, right? It's a hierarchical universe, and you go up just one notch from where you are right now. And going through the planetary mortal epochs and then into the beginning stages of light and life is parallel to going through the mansion worlds, right? So, you're definitely going to have a fair amount of, by light and life on a world, you're going to have a fair amount of sin and iniquity in the rearview mirror. But no one's perfect. Right? So evil is always possible. All right, so you had that. Remember they gave us a little bit of insight into a few details of a particular world in light and life, in the first stage of light and life. And that was sort of the contrasting thing. Instead of, well, things are not as material, idyllic as you imagine on the one hand. And on the other hand, you're able to imagine some things that you would like to implement right now in your society that technically are not proper now. Those are proper when you get to light and life, and you've really definitively moved beyond the need for the profit motive, for instance. Things, you know. So remember, it was sort of this double-edged sword of trying to get us in a more realistic mode about golden ages, what they are, but that's then, and what they aren't. Okay, so we have, so that's where they, they basically, had taken us, and then that last little paragraph that we read before we stopped, remember they were giving us a sense of where we pick up in the scope of Revelation. Once you've gone through all the planetary moral epics, remember that, post-planetary prints, you're revealing up to the system, local system level, and then it's the constellation level, and then it's the local universe level, then it's the super universal level, and then it's the central universe with the Trinity teacher sons. And, so then what's after that? Remember, you get the universe of universes. So, finally in the first stage of light and life, you're going to start to get some very definitive teaching about what's going on in all seven super universes from the perspective of it being a universe of local universes. Right, so that foundational level of the whole collection. I mentioned it in terms of the other six super universes to begin with there, because remember what's one of the big distinctions between each of the seven super universes. There's seven schemes, one of which is the ascension scheme, right, in the universe of universes. And in those other six, one of the other schemes is the dominant scheme. It's in our super universe that the ascension scheme is the dominant one. That's between the lines of that. You're going to start to be taught more about all those other six schemes. And you can imagine beings that are not revealed here in the Revelation that's so limited to the ascension scheme. Lots and lots of those unrevealed beings would start to come into play, interacting with those worlds once they get to light and life. So all that complexity starting to happen. And then they gave us a little tease for what we'll be getting to here in a little bit of, what about after the first stage of light and life? And they say that you're going to start working on the facet of deity that's called the sevenfold, and you're going to start working on that by very definitively examining it, examining things from the individuality viewpoint, where you have all of the complexity of individuals, starting with that first level, where you have the Creator Sons, Great Mother Spirits, Master Physical Controllers, and you're going to try to assimilate all that complexity and try to somehow then transcend it and get a sense of the wholeness of it all. So that you can begin to get a sense of the deity, as they said, while the deity study of the second age, get a sense of that that unity that is the deity that permeates and is common in all that complexity. So in both of those, remind yourself of this paper is one of two papers in a block that's about universal coordination. Right? And see, it's there that you're starting. We definitely were talking about coordination when we had the Trinity Teacher Son age, prior to the first stage of light and life. They're bringing in that coordination of the parts that were given before that into a whole. But now you're really seeing, if they go to the first stage of the universe of universes, very definitively we're talking about universal coordination. coordination. See? So very literally, like the nature of the this block of papers, you're seeing that there, that you're giving you universal, teaching about universal coordination in the with the universe of universes, and then really getting into deity like they had before. All right, so that's all of that, and it seemed like we were, it's like, oh, we got to stop in the middle of the section, continuing with more of that. But actually, if you look at what we're about to read, the rest of this section, it serves as a preface for the next section. See, the next section is administrative readjustments. Okay? And this little block at the end of this section, of section 3 here, starts to more directly talk about administration. Okay, so it actually worked out really well. And so we can kind of shift gears now, and we're going to focus in on some of the details of how these worlds are administered. And it probably doesn't hurt to just remind yourself of the literalness of the word, because when you say administration, we tend to glaze over and think hopeless bureaucracy, and I turn that stuff off. But remember, it's ministry, right? If you just remind yourself that the word is, the root is ministry, the prefix just means to, right? And so you're not speaking of just some sort of abstract ministry, but very definitively applied ministry, ministry pointed at, to something, the AD prefix, right? And so, you're talking about another aspect of cosmic ministry that can be just as profound and advanced and as delightful, as any other ministry that you can imagine. Right? It's don't judge primitive expressions of administration. Don't judge administration by primitive expressions of administration that we tend to see around us all the time. Okay, so let's see what they've got here.
A planet the size of Urantia, when fairly well settled, would have about 100 sub-administrative centers. These subordinate centers would be presided over by one of the following groups of qualified administrators. 1. Young material sons and daughters brought from the system headquarters to act as assistants to the ruling Adam and Eve.
Okay, but just we'll just pause briefly on each of the seven, because there's a lot of differential in each of these seven. So you've remember how when you read in the book about the plans for our Adamic ministry, that they were going to be regional centers and whatnot. That's always the case. You don't just have the planetary headquarters where the planetary prince is. Very early on, you begin to establish these secondary centers around the planet, and it goes all the way into light and life, as you can see here. Okay, and so then there's all these different beings, individuals that can take up these secondary leadership roles at these sub-administrative centers. One seems pretty obvious. If Adam and Eve are very much taking this tangible leadership role, right? I mean, you can't see the planetary prince, right? So if Adam and Eve are very tangibly taking a leadership role, not surprising that you might use other material sons and daughters in a similar fashion. So apparently, they dematerialize, transport, rematerialize some other material sons and daughters to worlds. That's one possibility. one would certainly not suspect that there's any procreation going on with those, right? That wouldn't seem reasonable. You know, they're just there to serve as administrators, not as biologic uplifters in any way, because that's by light and life. I mean, even if there was problems with the original biologic uplift, that's all really, you know, been taken care of. And so they're just coming as very handy, tangible material beings, very easy for the material mortals to interact with such beings and work as great administrators.
Do you feel that they could possibly be the original offspring of our original Adam and Eve?
You're jumping ahead. We'll see in a little bit about whether or not the offspring of the Adam and Eve that were left behind on the system headquarters world, do they play a role? We'll see in a little bit.
Because our Adam and Eve is already into the ascension scheme.
But here, right, I mean, and again, remember, we're not just talking about here, right, you know, but in general, you know, any world. Right? But you can see just, they obviously kept it very general here. You know, it doesn't say anything about the, you know, the actual children of that planet's Adam and Eve that were back on that system's headquarter world, you know, just material sons and daughters, you know, whatever, in general. So you know, that tells you that it could be in general, right? It's not limited right there. So, you know, there's going to be countless different variables, you know. For instance, about why you don't want, you know, someone that's really closely related, maybe. I mean, who knows? We don't really know what we're talking about, you know, for the needs here.
Well, the offspring of Adam and Eve that went back are not material sons and daughters.
Right. We're not talking about, you know, in our case, we're not talking about anyone that were procreated here.
Right.
We're talking about material sons and daughters coming from the local system headquarters world, right?
Yeah.
You know, out of the pool of material sons and daughters that Adam and Eve were drawn from originally. Okay, so that's one option. That's a pretty straightforward option. Okay, what about number two?
Two, the progeny of the semi-mortal staff of the planetary prince, who were procreated on certain worlds for this and other similar responsibilities.
Okay, so now remember about the corporeal staff of the planetary prince. You know, don't misinterpret what's being stated there. That, you know, it's always the case that before, you know, when the Adam and Eve on a world arrive, before that original staff, you know, are taken back to the local system headquarters world, they've procreated material progeny to take over their jobs when they leave, right? And those, you know, those are very much like the progeny of the Adam and Eve, right? They're mortal, you know, they're adjuster indwelt, right? You know, so they have a limited lifespan. You know, and we're talking, you know, who knows how many hundreds of thousands of years have rolled by here. But those progeny, you know, procreate and maintain an ongoing staff for the planetary prince. You know, clear into light and life here, as we see. Except in rare exceptions, they haven't mated with any evolutionary mortals. You know, they're just procreating to maintain a staff for the planetary prince. And so they're at least there for that. But here they're reminding you, they may also be procreating to have more than just a staff at the planetary headquarters, but to have, you know, to help administrate these sub-administrative centers. Okay? So they would up their numbers a little bit, right, to handle that. Again, you know, except in extremely rare cases, there's, you know, not for any procreation with the evolutionary mortals. Yeah. Okay, so that's, you know, see, so that when they say on certain worlds, for this and similar responsibilities. You know, that's just, it's on all worlds that they're there for the planetary headquarters, but on certain worlds, beyond that. Okay, so that's what that's about. You know, so that might have caught you off guard. You might have forgotten about the fact that you've got that, that, you know, if things had gone as they should have with our planetary prince, we not only would have Adam and Eve still here, but we would have those corporeal staff members. You know, a little different than Adam and Eve that, you know, are immortal. But, you know, there would be these special mortals, you know, that would just be there at the headquarters, you know, and would have been, you know, for 500,000 years now.
Would the corporeal staff members who made it, et cetera, would they be partaking of the Tree of Life?
No, so you mean, it's, remember, this is like just Adam and Eve did the Tree of Life. Just, you know, in our case, this original 100.
That's what I thought.
You know, when they procreate, those are a downstepped phenomenon, just like the children of Adam and Eve, right? So they're not immortal; they're mortal. They're not, you know, partaking of the fruit of the tree of life. So they're just you know, they would be very profound biologic mortals. You know, so they would live for a long time. You know, they would have been living for a very long lifespan since way back when, whereas it's only now that humans are starting to live. Remember, humans are living up to about 500 years now, right? But those individuals probably, you know, start out with really, really long lifespans like that, you know? So you haven't had trillions of generations of them, you know, they're only living 30 years or something, right? Yeah. But still, remember that on a normal world, this is a long time in the future, right? I mean, just the prince's age is, you know, like 500,000 years, say, you know, but, you know, all of those subsequent planetary mortal epochs, you know, tens and thousands, hundreds of thousands, I mean, it's a long, long time that they've been procreating just to maintain that staff at the headquarters. Okay. All right. So that one's a little bit more, you know, unexpected. What about the next one?
Three. The direct planetary progeny of Adam and Eve.
Okay, here you go. Oh, here's the answer to the question that you might have been wondering. You know, I think we even talked about that a while back. You know, you have this thought. It's like, well, okay, so an Adam and Eve come and they procreate, and I mean, does that, you know, do they stop after, you know, some, you know, reasonable length of time when they've got gazillions of descendants? No, it looks like even in the light and life, they're still procreating. So unlike, remember, you know, we were talking about that with the mortals on a world in light and life, how you can kind of think of your whole lifespan and stretching it out to, say, 500 years, but we notice that they specifically mentioned, no, women being able to have children doesn't get, you know, multiplied by five. You know, in terms of length of time, you know, that still is a relatively short span of time. Not Eve. Eve on a world, she's still completely fertile, apparently indefinitely. Hundreds of thousands of years have gone by, and she's still popping out babies. So, pretty impressive. Because remember, those babies are mortal, right? So if you got them in light and life here, serving as administrators, they weren't born that long ago.
But doesn't that kind of change the ratio of the violet stock to the evolutionary stock over time? I mean,
well, of course. See, so you got, you know, that's why I'm bringing this up. It's like, oh, wow, I never thought about how complicated a logistics this is. I mean, you know, you aren't just giving this spurt and then it feeds in. I mean, this is spread out over a long span of time. You know, it reminds you of, you know, when they tell you, you know, you had the Adamic blood in Mesopotamia, you know, and it went out in waves, you know, but, you know, there was less and less until, you know, you drained the reservoir, And there's, you know, and we're not going to get any more. That's it. That's all we've got. You know, had you ever thought about it in this light? It's like, oh, in a normal world, no matter what happens, the reservoir is never drained because Eve can always, Adam and Eve can always make more babies.
And do.
And do. See, so that's an interesting thing. See, that you may not have ever had in your equation in thinking about this. And it's just, you know, you got this one tiny little thing that, you know, you need to reflect on. It's like, oh, that has consequences about how they manage this biologic uplift. And, maybe there's a whole process to this where you can biologic uplift to a certain amount, blending it in, and you blend it, and then you need to, you know, add another dose. I mean, there's probably a whole science to this, see? So anyway.
So the offspring are mortal.
Right.
And so they're 500 years and out.
You know, or who knows how long, you know, last whatever.
At the very least, they need to replenish for that.
Yeah. All right, so, I mean, obviously, if you're going to use the offspring of Adam and Eve for something besides just producing another generation of offspring, you've got to, you know, they've got to procreate for that with that in mind, too. Okay, so see, that's a fun little tidbit. Okay, the next one is pretty intriguing. Oh, you got a question? Okay.
Huge question.
Yep.
It almost sounds like to advance, you know, to the later stages of life, that the ratio of vial of blood has to be extremely high, that you can't do it, you know, with a... There's a limit to how much evolutionary stock you can have and still make it to life.
Well, let me just, you know, comment on that. Remember, there's also the statement that they give us that they basically tell you there's a limit of how much you can do to uplift the stock directly by mating with Adam and Eve's children. You also have to do a lot of the uplifting by genetic engineering. Right. See, so it isn't all solved by just having her procreating and feeding more in all the time. That has its limits. It's this complex combination. See, you know, like I said, maybe you do some genetic engineering and then you do an additional biologic uplift, and maybe something, you know, there's a super additive consequence or you know, that wasn't there before. I mean, there must be something really complicated, you know, about it all.
So science becomes involved.
Right, well, lots of science, yeah. Nothing but science. That should just really kind of get your speculation gears turning about the potential complexity of that whole biologic uplift phenomenon. Okay, then look at this, another little fun tidbit.
For materialized and humanized midway creatures.
That's my next question.
Okay, so now we'll see in a little bit. There's another, thing you can do with midway creatures.
Wow.
Okay, but let's start with this one. So here they're literally telling you that you're going to take the midway creatures, and you don't know if this is primaries and secondaries, just secondaries. But anyway, midway creatures, so you can modify them so... they're literally materialized. You know, it isn't like, say, a secondary midway right now where it can manifest visibly if it wants to, but sort of its normal state, it's not visible. Here you're modifying them, so they're just like us. They're just visible all the time, period. So you modify the energy of their body so it's much more like the energy of our bodies. And they just are materialized.
Wow.
Okay.
It seems to me like, A, they'd be mortal, and B, they would become adjuster and dwelt.
Well, you're jumping ahead. We haven't gone through the whole thing yet. It's right there, yeah. So what's the humanized about?
Well, that's just obvious.
Yeah, right.
Serious downgrade.
Right, but just because they're materialized, you can't conclude that.
Oh, really?
For instance, consider the original material son and daughter on Gerasim. Right, they are just period immortal, right? There isn't even an issue of, you know, they can get their mind out of whack and come unplugged and then they're mortal like all of their offspring on Gerasim. That original pair, they're just as material as I am, but they're innately immortal. Right? So just because you say materialized, right? Or think about Havona natives. They're material. Okay, now it is Havona material, a central universe material, not our kind of material, but still they're material. And they're obviously immortal. They're eternal. Right? So, see, there's a, you know, that's what I was just about to say when you were jumping the gun there, see, is just notice that it doesn't just say materialized midway creatures. It's got another word that they've added in there, right? Materialized and quote-unquote humanized, right? And here's, you know, when they make a noun, a verb out of the noun like that, it's very important to remember what I'm constantly trying to get you to have at the fore of your mind when you see the word human. Okay? It, you know, think of it literally meaning up from the humus, right? I repeat it all the time to try to pound it into your head to get you to think about it. When you say human, you're thinking very definitively of an upward pointing arrow, not just a blob that's sitting there, but something that is oriented up, right? Is an actual flow, if you will, upward out of the dirt. Just, you know, that's the truth of the old story, right? In Genesis and other human stories of you being formed out of clay sort of stuff, right? Right, that's the truth of being human, up from the humus. A midway creature is a stationary phenomenon, right? It's not descending or ascending. It's just this blob of energy that's at a certain level, right? So you're going to modify the blob, if you will, but then you're also going to directionize it. You're going to make it an upward moving phenomenon, an ascending phenomenon. You're going to humanize it. Right. Now, if you humanize it, now it can take an adjuster. Right. Right? An adjuster is striking step with that upwardness. Right? I mean, why don't angels, seraphim, cherubim, you know, whatnot, why don't they get adjusters?
Yeah.
Right? Because they're not an ascending phenomenon that an adjuster can strike step with. Yeah.
To clarify something I was confused about. I assumed that we were upward pointing because of the adjuster. Well, that's not true.
No.
Because of the humus.
No. I mean, you are created, right? You have a creator. There's a phenomenon that's drawn you up. Right?
And the adjuster is...
It's just striking step with that, right? Coming in parallel with it, striking step with it. And you know, it definitely puts your upward potential on steroids, right? Because it's, you know, now spirit gravity can grab a hold of that spirit nugget and, you know, and pull you up like an elevator cable, pulling you up, right? But still, fundamentally, you are established as something that's upwelling. Now, that upwelling can only go so far, and something's got to step in, you know, to be able to take it further, but you are upwelling.
Yeah. Why? And what's the mechanism? Is it the sixth adjunct? What's...
As if we understand the physics of humanization. See, that's what I'm thinking. You see, this is obviously physics, right?
Yeah.
Right? They are modifying the energy system in some way, so now it is this upward-oriented... Okay, I mean, this is so beyond our understanding of physics, right? What does that mean, right? But remember how there's all these, you know, even the revelators don't understand all that physics. You know, like, they don't understand why some humans can't, you know, get, be father fusers, right? And are only spirit fusers, right? See, and again, it has something to do with this very subtle physics. And so when you think about, well, who does this humanizing? And I see there's a mystery there. Someone understands this physics.
Sure. Right.
Someone's making these modifications. Right. So materialized and humanized, upwardized, humanized. And, you know, it does make you wonder a little bit, you know, if it's like, well, I know with the secondary midwayers, they have the sixth and seventh adjutants already, you know, and if I materialize them, am I making it so now they have all seven adjutants? You know, and that would seem like that wouldn't be too big of a step. It's like, well, yeah, but what about the primary midwayers? Okay, they don't have adjutant mind ministry at all to begin with. I mean, so, you know, there's a lot of unanswered questions here. But anyway, yeah, you know, that's what they're doing. So they're modifying the energy system in terms of just its placeness, and then they're directionizing it, making it an upward oriented phenomenon. Yeah. Only.
Yeah. Okay. A silly question, but yeah. the original Adam and Eve's, they are innately eternal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Immortal.
Immortal. Are they aging at all, or are they just as fresh as the day they came?
Yeah, I think we talked about that before. Again, you know, there's a, you know, with that original Adam and Eve.
Yeah.
You know, they were created, remember, by Michael directly.
Correct.
Okay, so they weren't born babes.
Okay, so there's not going to be any physical
degeneration. But in terms, right, I mean, you know, but you still have the question, it's like, well, does he make them in a certain way and they never change any? Is there any maturation sort of biologically to them? They don't explain, I don't know. I mean, you'd just be speculating if there is some kind of maturation that has to occur subsequent to their creation. You know, I don't know.
Right now, they'd be looking pretty grim.
But obviously, you know, the two of them, then, you know, they must just, you know, if either they're made just definitively complete to start with, or they have some little ramp and then they plateau and they just stay the same, you know, forever after that.
Sure.
But, you know, when they procreate, you know, you got a baby in a womb and it's born, and you know, I mean, all their offspring are just like we understand material procreation. You know, they aren't doing the, you know, like the what led to primary midwives or anything like that. The children of those first material sons and daughters, you know, aren't being brought into existence as adults, right? But those two were, you know, Michael created them as adults, you know, quote unquote. Okay. Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. So many questions I keep forgetting here.
Midway creatures.
Yeah.
A couple things. One is that their overall destiny is the core, right? I mean, so they do evolve eventually. They when they leave the planet after a certain stage of Trinity Suns begin there, they do go on up.
Yep.
So they do have that long-term mm-hmm. aspect. And then this materialized things that possibly, you know, later on, they adjust your vision, so it's one way or another, to be able to, you know, envision midway creatures as the planet really evolves.
Again, we're, that we
now,
get
maybe materialized means that they
are, no, you'll
they
see
are, but that's after that stage when they are.
You'll see that it's not that by what they say in the next section.
So what they do is, by materialized, then they would be visible when they're materialized.
Yeah. So for those of you in the webinar, to give you kind of gauge what he's talking, he's trying to understand exactly what, you know, why are they materialized, and, you know, and what does that mean? Are they literally just, you know, so now you can take a picture of them with a Polaroid camera, and sure enough, there they are, or
just, you
know,
you're changed.
Or is it because, you know, our vision has been modified, and now we can see them? That's not it, as we'll see in the next section. Here, see, and I was about to explain that. Well, why are they materialized? Because as we'll see as we go through this whole list here, you can see everything we've got so far, we're talking about these leaders of these sub-administrative centers have to be literal, corporeal creatures, okay? Right? So it's in that, you know, it's you can understand it contextually like that, that it is literal. They're literally being materialized. You know, so that they fit in with the other. Otherwise, it'd be one of these things is not like the others, right?
Yeah.
If you know Sesame Street.
So it has to be far enough into light and life where they're not necessary
any longer in the numbers that they are functioning as midwayers.
Yeah, and
this is one of the ways they exit the plant.
Yeah, and that's what we haven't gotten to yet. That's what's coming up in the next section, talking about, you know, the destiny of midwayers. Right. So, all of us who know a lot of things about the book, but. You know, in terms of just stepping along, they haven't told you that yet about all those details about the future of the midwayers here. That's coming up next. Okay, what's the next one here?
5. Mortals of adjuster fusion status who, upon their own petition, are temporarily exempted from translation by the order of the personalized adjuster of universe chieftainship, in order that they may continue on the planet in certain important administrative posts.
Okay. Now you see kind of, and like I said, they start to get, there's all these little interesting tidbits. It's like, oh, I didn't know that was even an option. All right, so you're talking about, the normal run-of-the-mill father fuser mortal literally you initiate this upon their own petition, which is pretty fascinating. You can get the personalized adjuster that's in charge of the local universe to tell the thought adjuster, don't allow fusion to occur. Even if they've moved all the way to that point, you keep a millimeter back, so the fusion doesn't happen, right? Just take one step back. Apparently the adjuster is still with them, right? But it's been ordered to not allow that final step to happen.
Don't blow a bucket.
So... it's like, wow. I thought it was going through a lot of rigmarole to materialize and humanize a midway creature just so I could have a corporeal administrator. But that sounds like a pretty significant thing to do just to have a corporeal administrator. So you're starting to get the flavor of it now. There's all kinds of different sort of advanced corporeal minds that you could put in these positions of administrative authority. And depending upon the planet and the circumstances and the history and what have you, all these different options are in play. And I'm sure several of them are used on any given planet, probably too.
Might that even be the case with a human that's important in a role and, the adjuster's like, we have some timing issues here where we want to make sure this guy's in play before fusion.
If those on the web couldn't hear that, it obviously gets your gears turning again. It's like, well, okay, outside of this one issue, well, if you can do this for this, can you do it for other reasons too? Doesn't seem like there's anything, that limits it to just this. Apparently the personalized adjuster, the local universe could order this at any time. If one of us was close to fusion, which none of us are, but if one of us were close to fusion, apparently, this could be prevented from happening. And so you may not have thought about it as being so manageable like that. It was sort of just, well, there's no stopping it now. It's on irreversible. No, there's actually universe's mind made and personality managed. And you see personalized adjuster. So everything, has a knob that can be turned. Right? Okay.
Yeah. Well, of course, the thought at this point on this planet to volunteer to stay on for a period of time as in some managerial, you can forget that. But by that time, you're so developed, and you have a better grasp of time and the whole cosmic scheme. So they could be possibly competing for the privilege of volunteering to stay on.
Yeah, very much so. That's the key thing at the end.
The In a way, that's what Jesus did.
Yeah, in a way, yes.
Yeah.
But stress. Remember, they stressed this, that you have sublime privilege, sort of consciousness in play here.
Sure.
I mean, to rise to the level of self mastery,
yeah,
that you would even be considered for such, a role. Very few would ever achieve such degree of self-mastery that they would even be considered for such a thing, right? So yes, you've challenged yourself, and you've gotten this great honor of being given this incredible trust, because of your sublime self-mastery. Okay, just one little aside. In our case, in our local universe, the personalized adjuster of universe chieftainship is what adjuster?
Jesus.
Right. Machaventa and Jesus is adjuster. Right. That adjuster was personalized and became, the one that's in charge of the whole local universe. All right. So if that were to happen on this planet, sometime in the future, that's who would be involved in that order. Okay, what about the next thing here?
6. Specially trained mortals of the planetary schools of administration who have also received the Order of Supreme Service of the Marantia Temple.
See, so now that they put that Order of Supreme Service thing in context here, it helps us stress what I was trying to stress before. Okay, they don't just mean, I love the word supreme because it makes me sound fancy. Right, they mean literally supreme service. So we're talking about very advanced self-mastery again. See, that you achieved supreme service. You have such a mastered self. Yeah, none of us can even imagine mastering ourselves to where we could, transcend merely finite service and manifest supreme service. Okay. And get this award in the temple. To think that that's different than the previous one. Right. So it just reminds you that there is. You're right. There's different ways in which you can be appropriate for this role. Whether or not someone who's gotten this Order of Supreme Service might also be in the mode where there had to be this issue that they need to delay fusion, maybe so, but you can see they're separate. So you could have someone who didn't get this Supreme Order or the Order of Supreme Service, right? But still had to have their fusion delayed. So just, they're not equivalent. All right, and then one last option here.
7. Certain elective commissions of 3 properly qualified citizens who are sometimes chosen by the citizenry by direction of the planetary sovereign in accordance with their special ability to accomplish some definite task which is needful in that particular planetary sector.
Okay, so then if it's not one that can do it by his or herself, you can get a superadditive consequence of 3 of them that can do it. Okay, now, and obviously 3 is not a random number here, right? I mean, it's got to be the threefold actuality that is coming together in a triunity, a superadditive triunity, that can function together as one, as one of these administrators. So that too kind of reminds you of how much is embodied in one of these individuals that's doing it by themselves,
really?
If they're kind of equivalent to the superadditive consequence of 3. Okay. All right. Between those 3, where it's mortals, you definitely get a a pretty good sense of exactly what kind of a mind is involved here. And, you know, the midware doing it or a material son and daughter doing it is of an equal mindal quality. All right. The logistics of that, that it's sometimes chosen by the citizenry by direction of the planetary sovereign. Obviously, there's all sorts of details that we can't understand there. But they love to give you those details, even if it's not at all apparent why the planetary sovereign has to, do this, direct it and whatnot. To just remind you of how precise everything is, how definitive the order in the cosmos is. I mean, nothing is happenstance. Everything has this whole logistic precision to it in the cosmos, right? And it's very important for them to constantly remind you that the universe is the opposite of what we scientifically assume, right? That in the beginning was chaos, and magically out of chaos, came our experiences. That fundamentally there's no order. There's just magic. No, there's no magic. Because there's no magic, the foundation of reality has to be very definitively ordered. Yeah. Right? Or where could even some crude order come from? Right?
Another quick comment. We discussed earlier that through each dispensation, humankind is given more and more information relative to our ascent.
Right.
And here we are, on the bottom, and we've got this, good Lord. Mm-hmm. I mean, this would take us into light and life. I mean, that kind of information, maybe not that kind of detail, but it again emphasizes the extraordinary nature of being on this bleak planet as we see it through childish eyes.
But good to just to point out in that regard, when I was mentioning up front about first stage of light and life, you're getting the universe of universes, and the second stage, they were getting to all the details. Remember the protean concept of, the first level of God, the sevenfold. Even though this revelation is giving us a lot of things way ahead of time, it's not giving us anything about those other six schemes.
That's true.
See, and we've gotten to the point now where they're talking about people on the planet having something that's not even remotely in this revelation.
Chris, what's another scheme?
That's the thing we don't know.
Oh.
You got the ascension scheme, and they tell you there's six other schemes.
We don't know.
And we don't know what they are because they weren't allowed to reveal them.
I kept looking for it.
No. All right,
you just know it's tantamount to ascension. But that's about all.
Something as significant as the ascension scheme, right. There's six others. From our perspective, obviously nothing could be as significant.
Spoken like an ascendant.
And yet they all ascend, right?
They all ascend. It's just, in the first super universe, one of those other six schemes is the dominant scheme. Right? Ascension scheme is a secondary thing there. Yeah. But even though it's secondary there, the first person to make it to Havona was from the first super universe. See? So, again... You're thinking, we're first because we got the ascension scheme. Yeah, no, we're probably last to get to Havona out of the seven super universes, right? So let's see. Yeah, so anyway, so that issue, that's important to notice that we're really getting to some advanced stuff now as being universal on the planet. Stuff that's transcendent of the revelatory mandate, right, is common knowledge right now. I mean, just getting into the first stage of light and life. So, it kind of puts some humility, right, into your relationship with the revelation. It's a lot, but it's not everything. Let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? So then see what else they give us here before they finish up the section.
The great handicap confronting Urantia in the matter of attaining the high planetary destiny of light and life is embraced in the problems of disease, degeneracy, war, multicolored races, and multilingualism.
Okay, now very important that you don't skip over any words and when you reflect on that paragraph. Embraced in the problems of. Okay, so it's not, you know, it doesn't say, you know, that the matter of attaining the high planetary destiny of light and life is the problems of. Right? It says it's embraced in the problems of. So they want you to step back, reflect on that list, and figure out what is the common fact there that encompasses those, that those are just different facets within one fact. I mean, what leads to all those issues?
Genetics.
Right, obviously, yes. Right. There's no amount of us wishing for the golden age in the future is going to get us there, because it's not genetically accessible to us yet.
We ain't got the stuff.
We do not have the biology. Okay. And that limited biology manifests in a number of ways. They're just kind of giving you the spectrum of it. You know, one, you know, your limited biology makes you way too prone to disease. Two, it's degenerate, right? Right? I mean, we literally have subhumans on the planet, you know, that are shaped like me, right? That's pretty degenerate, right? Why is one of them war? Well, because war is natural, right? That's what you do naturally. It has nothing to do with defaults or rebellions or anything like that. That's just, when your genetics is so limited that you can't become an artificial enough phenomenon to overrule what's natural. Right? Peace is artificial. War is natural. So again, it's basically a degeneracy problem. It's, you know, your biology is too low, sort of a thing. So your mind isn't functioning high enough. Multicolored races. Now, you know, you may recall they've kind of touched on this, that it's not just that you don't have one race. That's not what they mean by multicolored races. You know, they would have just said multiple races if that's what they meant. Okay, what they mean is you have even if it's just one race, it's a multicolored race. It's a race where internally the racial, you know, the Sangic heritage, for instance, is at cross purposes, right? You know, like say the yellow man and the red man inside of me is such that it hasn't been managed into a coordinated thing, you know, or a phenomenon that's all in this, going in the same direction. Inside, part of me is wanting to go this way, and another part's wanting to go that way, and it's just tearing me apart inside. Okay, that internal discord, it makes it, you can't get up to very high levels of harmony. Right? So you're just genetically not harmonious, so no amount of, you know, of attempting to overcome that can take you very far. It's going to have limits. And you can't bootstrap yourself up to light and life with that internal, you know, those internal cross currents. So again, see, it's a genetic issue. A very basic one, you know, language is tied to genetics, right? You have Indo-European language commonality because of Andite genetic commonality. You have Finno-Ugric, you know, language commonality because of Andonite commonality, etc. Right, and so, you know, that's a very basic thing that you just, as you bring the, as you coordinate all of the genetic stock together and uplift it, you just transcend that diversity of languages. And so that's just kind of an indicator, see, of lowliness of genetics, that you have that natural diversity of biology, so that you have that natural diversity of how a mind attunes to that biology, so you have a natural diversity of languages. Natural diversity of how concepts form in the mind. Okay. All right, so all those, see, yeah, it's a genetic issue. That's the great handicap. Okay, and then what else do they say?
No evolutionary world can hope to progress beyond the first stage of settledness in light until it has achieved one language, one religion, and one philosophy. Being of one race greatly facilitates such achievement, but the many peoples of Urantia do not preclude the attainment of the higher stages.
See, so right there, friends, I was just alluding to that. So fundamentally, you don't have to get the one race thing, you know, very early on. So that's kind of a, well, at least, you know, we know we're going to have a long-term problem with getting one race because it was so unmanaged. So, you know, that's an encouraging, that's good news. That's the gospel there. That fact doesn't fundamentally hold us up. But now the multicoloredness of our multiple races is, okay, is an issue. The fact that we can't transcend the cross currents yet. Okay. But anyway, so that's an interesting point. But see, like I was saying before, obviously, as you are upstepped, you're going to transcend the multilingualism. You're going to have one language. And we talked about this before, as I recall. You know, eventually, remember, you're really transcending science and religion as we think of those things. And you're really, you know, approaching everything from the top down. It really is just philosophy that sort of has, you know, phases within it that are oriented towards ideals on the one hand and ideas on the other, quote-unquote religion and science, respectively. Okay, but it really is philosophy. You know, you've gotten up to where you have one philosophy, and then you're approaching religion anew from a transcendent perspective. So one religion is just an automatic consequence of one philosophy.
Sure.
Right? Because you're approaching religion from the top down. The multifaceted religions, you know, can't be merged together into one religion. You know, like you can merge races together into one race. You have to transcend all the religions we have right now and establish a genuine philosophy and then reconstitute a true religion from the top down. so that, you know, that's just the normal thing. It isn't, you know, it's not the, you know, the genetic handicap like they were, you know, pointing out that we have in the previous paragraph there. But, you know, you can think about it in our case. You know, just what a challenge, you know, when you imagine light and life, right? I mean, the main thing that you've got to try to imagine is kindred minds, right? Not kindred spirits. That, you know, that's, we already have that by grace, and okay, it's not getting us very far. Right, since for the last 2,000 years, you know, we've been, our kindred spiritness has been literally factualized. We all have thought adjusters, okay? We still have a tendency to be rude and a little bit more to one another, right? Still a lot of warring going on. You know, we're still in total moral decadence and whatnot. Right, I mean, that, to try to imagine the literalness of light and life where, you know, everyone is on the same page intellectually, right? Where everyone is, you know, has a clear recognition of the universal harmony, of the cosmos, of the philosophy on high, you know, and is able to bring that down into their mind, right? You know, so that we are kindred minds. Right, that's obviously a very tall order,
yeah.
Right? You know, and you know, like they're saying, you can imagine getting you know into the beginning stages of a light and life. See, but you know, no evolutionary world can hope to progress beyond the first stage, right? Until these things are very definitive. You have this one philosophy, and you have now, you know, produced one religion from that. Okay, so you know, that's the fullness of the first stage, and then you can move on to the second stage. Yeah.
Pa- putting in language that I can relate to very quickly, it isn't it basically the adoption or the recognition of a cosmic perspective, a full-on cosmic perspective?
Right, there's just this common cosmic consciousness,
period.
Cosmic perspective, as you're saying. Right, you remember how when we went through the mansion worlds, they were pointing out, you know, you get into the mansion worlds away, and okay, now the individuals on the mansion worlds are seriously having, you know, are able to possess quote unquote cosmic consciousness. You know, we're talking about light and life here, so yeah, we're in those, you know, we're fifth, sixth, seventh mansion world, right? You know, where you've got that ability to really contain the essence of the universal harmony in your mind, right? I mean, it's more the capacity, right? I mean, it's not like you have to take what you've got and just kind of rearrange it, and then the cosmos will fit down into it. Right? I mean, it's just, you know, literally everyone has to get the capacity, supply the favorable conditions, and the cosmos is just put into your mind.
Okay.
Right?
So you don't need a revelation necessarily.
You don't need a revelation, but you need lots of encouragement to utilize your capacity, you know, to supply the favorable conditions so that capacity is actually available to be filled with something from above. And then, you know, all this genetic engineering and biologic uplift, you know, we're talking about, you know, I mean, that's just literally giving you greater capacity. You know, but still, once you have technically the capacity, if you haven't, you know, properly prepared the soil, as it were, in that whole space, the cosmos is not going to be forced into it, right? They're not going to get a big scoop and scoop out all your garbage and then put the cosmos into it. I mean, you have free will, control of that domain. You have to supply the favorable conditions, and then you will be grown into a cosmic character. Now, and same is true now. Any sort of cosmic consciousness that you have is grown into you by grace, predicated on you supplying the favorable conditions. Right? So like we said, you know, work on loyal, humble, sincere, just, patient. Right? Those are favorable conditions. Do those very well. You can be guaranteed that some of the cosmos will now be resident within the upper domain of the hourglass and knowledge of your mind. It will be there, and you will begin to manifest the fruits of that nature naturally, automatically. Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. All right. So I guess we got everything there. Yeah. So just to stress again, though, one last point. You know, since I was really focusing you again on how philosophy is the key. Right? I mean, this is about universal coordination. Right? I mean, the only thing that can get you into relationship with coordination is philosophy. Science and religion in and of themselves is bottom-up phenomena like we have on this planet right now. Don't do it. Religion is the spark. It potentializes that, but it doesn't actualize that. You know, having a genuine religious consciousness potentializes cosmic consciousness, a philosophic mind, doesn't actualize it, right? You have spiritual consciousness with that religious consciousness, right? But you don't have cosmic consciousness.
You can't always actualize the philosophical concepts.
Yeah, we see it.
Especially in time.
Well, see, again, you know, a lot of this is predicated on using the word philosophy in a genuine way, not like humans use it. You know, that's one of the biggest challenges. Like, if I say this is a philosophic text, okay, but I don't mean the way philosophy is defined in the dictionary.
I understand that.
You know, and so there's that. You know, that's why I'm using, of course, philosophy. You know, it's in the, you know, the true meaning of that, you know, and...
Well, that's where wisdom comes in.
You know, and it's, right, it's a matter of, you know it has something to do with wisdom, has something to do with truth, It has something to do with the cosmos. Now you just kind of work on it. It's like, well, can I get a better definition of what wisdom means, you know, than what the dictionary says? Can I get a better definition of the word truth than what the dictionary says? And better definition of the word cosmos. Right, you have to, but you know, the different ways that you can come at it, you slowly start to recognize that there's this transcendent, objective, holistic perspective that you can have. And the different ways that you talk about that holistic perspective are through words like wisdom, truth, philosophy, and it's, you know, it, none of that really makes sense. It's just a bunch of abstract words until you kind of get up there and start to have an objectivity. It's like, oh, I'm above my initial religious spark now. I see. I see my religious nature in a context now, rather than the apex of a pyramid inside of me. And most of the time, I'm dwelling down in the nether regions of the pyramid. And occasionally, I go up to the peak and I'm religious, right? You know, the whole mountaintop analogy, right? We love to think in that terms because that's the way we perceive the cosmos. Is religion is the peak. And it's like, no, it's the beginning of something. You go through that up to something else, right? So the moment that you decide that there isn't anything above a sublime religious experience, it's the moment that you're now willfully blinding yourself to the potentials that are transcendent of that. And the fifth epical revelation is trying to get at what's after religion. Jesus was... You know, the fourth epical revelation was trying to get people to the starting point, right? I mean, there's no way to get to the cosmic if you aren't first religious, right? You have to go up to that starting point. You have to potentialize it. In terms of collectively, you can't be kindred minds until you're kindred spirits, right? Kindred spirits is the potential for kindred minds. The trick is to recognize it as a potential, begin to see religion as a potentiality instead of an actuality, and especially a final actuality, right? To make religion become, you know, a new thought in your mind, a new concept in your mind, a beginning rather than an ending, right? I mean, so you break out of that cycle that humans are in, the weekly cycle. You know, I dwell in the plane for 7 days, I go up to the mountaintop one day, and then I go back down to the plane for 6 days again. See, you know, to just stop that, you know, journey up and down, you know, in that inner pyramid, you know, the lower domain of the hourglass, basically, you know, you're just, you know, to see something be above the lower domain.
This is when we develop our own personal living philosophy.
Right, the personal living philosophy is in the upper domain.
Yeah.
And it's not in the lower domain. There is no philosophy in the lower domain of the hourglass.
That's right.
Right? The philosophic impulse is the neck. Right? You have to go through the neck to get to philosophy. You have to get up and engage the three cosmic intuitions and begin to think reflectively. It's a whole other universe, genuine philosophy,
literally.
Right? And it's a universe that the plain man has no awareness of. You're not born with any inherent awareness of the kind of consciousness in the upper domain. You have to take delight in cultivating, going up through and getting above and having this, right? As a conscious experience.
Challenge.
Okay, right. It's not natural. See, it's artificial. Philosophy's artificial. Science and religion are natural. Philosophy's not natural. Genuine philosophy. Opinion is natural, but opinion's not philosophy. Doctrines are natural. Doctrines aren't philosophy.
Right? How does that fit that saying you say where you're so heavenly minded you're no earthly good?
That's just basically, you dwell on the mountaintop, you know. Master, can't we just build tabernacles and stay here forever? Can't we just forever be so heavenly minded that we're no earthly good? Let's not go down onto the earth, the plane, right? I mean, that's just that, wanting to dwell on the mountaintop.
And a good philosophical approach should be able to keep you from getting to that.
The key is to not give up the mountaintop, but you know, having gotten up to the mountaintop, now jump. Take a leap of faith. There's something above that. Stake a claim above, and now reapproach the mountaintop from the top down. It'll make that mountaintop experience more sublime than you ever imagined.
Different.
Yeah. Approach religion from the top down rather than the bottom up, so that it's true religion, right, from the top down, instead of mere religion. Right? That's what they're trying to get you to. They're not trying to get you to give up religion. They're trying to get you to make it anew. Reform it from the top down, so that it's mind made and personality managed. Right? You know, religious experience is personal spiritual experience. There is no personal nature down here. Everyone only knows the religion of a fancy animal, mere adjutant religious impulse. No. See, so it's not personal spiritual experience. You have to get up to the personal domain, the upper domain. That's the only place that any mind is personalized. And having established an actual personalized consciousness, now approach your adjutant nature from the top down. Okay, that's what they're trying to get us to do. And it's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch have any concept of what we're talking about here.
And even us sitting here, we may have a concept. It's not always that easy to
Right. It's going to be very abstract.
It's a struggle.
Because if you start, if you just try to work your way up in terms of experiential understanding up the levels of meaning, you read about the level of the flesh, it's like, okay, I got that. You go up to the level of the feelings, I understand that. Now, what exactly is that next level, the level of mind? And you read it, it's like, I'm not sure I know what they're talking about here. And we're talking about going up not just to the third, but fourth, fifth, sixth, encompassing four, five, and six, bringing them down, remaking 3, 2, and 1. Okay? Right. What did Jesus say in that fear of the Lord section? He says, I find you experientially aware of the first and second levels of meaning, and I would lead you up. I mean, that's no one really is consciously aware that there's this whole other universe above the mountaintop, that they have access to. You have common sense. You get through life by the grace of your encirclement in the Holy Spirit. But see, it's not a conscious part of your life. You've never pulled common sense out in front of you and really turned it around and examined it and got the understanding of the physics of it, right? And, you just take it for granted. It's in the background. That you can do basic things. It's a matter of pulling back on the reins and taking a hold of that framework that you have unconsciously, your initial assumptions, getting them out in front and starting to examine them consciously. What is this about? What are these rudimentary framework issues that I'm functioning in? And that's nothing that happens naturally. And there's been very few people in all of human history that have even done it. There's very few people that have attempted reflective thinking to the point where they're validly a rudimentary philosopher or philosophic thinker.
Is that mastering your mind?
Right. See, the only way I can master my mind is if I get up there where I have a hold of, the handles on my mind. Right? I mean, I'm subjective down below. If I'm going to master my mind, I have to get above it so I can get down and grab a hold of it and do something with it. Otherwise, I'm just hopelessly inside of it. Can a drop of the water, in the ocean manipulate the ocean? No, the drop has got to get itself above.
So what masters your mind? Your personality, your spirit?
Yeah, your personality, right, is a mind-mastering potential. Personality has free will. It means it can take the normal causal sequence in the mind and alter it. Normally, the mind responds to a stimulus in a certain way, just the laws of mind energy.
It's an art form.
Right? But you have to take a hold of that. No, you're not going to respond this way. You're going to respond that way. Right? You have free will. You can do that. You aren't a helpless victim of the antecedent causation of the physics of your mind. A fear stimulus doesn't have to produce fear. You have free will.
Yeah. Part of this is it's not easy. It's not something you do directly. It's like first you have to be aware of what your mind's doing, so you kind of have to take a neutral perspective for a while and just watch how you responded to something.
Yeah.
How mechanically your mind just goes that way.
Yeah.
And you have to be able to separate from and see that mechanical.
Yes.
That's the way I always do it when that happens.
Yeah.
Programming.
And you have to you have to see it happen before you can have the objectivity to do otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's a simple example. I mean, when people use the word free will, see, what they're actually talking about is self-assertion. That they think that they have this creative, unique response to stimuli, and that's their personality. No, you're predictable to the 90th decimal place. There's no creativity at all. The universe knows exactly what you're going to do. Exactly what words will come out of your mouth. In every situation, you're completely predictable. There's no free will functioning there at all. Right? People don't know that because they've never gotten above it. It's like, wait a minute. I actually am just a machine. I'm responding to a stimulus the same way when I punch the R key on the typewriter, an R appears on the page. You got to get up and recognize that. There's no free will here. You're a machine. You know, you respond exactly the same to every stimulus. I mean, can you get objective in a study group, you know, that you've been in for years and years and years, where you've read a similar passage many times, and have you noticed that the people in the room say the exact same sentence every time, no matter if it's 5 years later, 10 years later, to when a certain sentence in the book is read? They're not a person, they're a machine that always says that. When there's that stimulus of that sequence of words in the book, a certain set of words come out of their mouth. They're not human. You know, they haven't availed themselves of their human nature to respond differently each time they're exposed to a stimulus. And of course, what you want to be responding is better each time to a stimulus. Going up, actually using your free will to alter the way your mind responds to a stimulus. You got to notice it. Yeah, but you know, first you're like a dog. I mean, you know, the first year, 5 years later, 10 years later, when that same passage is read, every time you think you've never said that before, and you have this original thought that you got to put out into the room. You know, but if you were listening to the recording or listening, it's like, wait a minute, I said the exact same words the last time.
Right.
I thought I just thought of those words. Yeah, it's just like the dog when you throw a stick. Every time you throw a stick, it's certain that that's the first time a stick has ever been thrown for it. That's why it's so excited.
Right.
No one's ever thrown a stick for me. 10 seconds later, you can throw it again. No one's ever thrown a stick for me. Are you just like that dog?
Yeah.
Where every time is the first time? Or have you gotten above and said, wait a minute, I'm repeating here. I'm repeating repeatedly.
I just fetched the ball again.
Is there anything I could do about that? Yes, there is. A human can change that vicious cycle. But not an animal. Not an animal origin subjective mind can't do anything about it. It's a helpless victim to antecedent causation. Right? Like Gene is saying, this is the first step. You've got to get up above that and notice just how hopelessly mechanical you are. And you've got to feel a deep hunger to not be so mechanical. I'm going to be creative.
And that idea
I'm going to respond to the same stimulus differently. I'm not just going to be a zealous believer where I believe doing the same thing over and over again, you know, is going to produce a different result.
It's not.
Right? But, you know, notice, it's sad to record. Almost everyone on the planet believes that. Well, it's going to be different next time. No, it's not. Oh, I'm more zealous this time. So it's going to be, no, at best it can be worst. There's no actual humans. No one's availing themselves of their human nature. They're encircled in the Holy Spirit. They're just fancy animals doing the same thing over and over again.
Their animal nature.
Yeah. Okay, anyway. When we get to the age of the light and life, see, we are way beyond that. Right? And it's one of the reasons why it's so hard for us to even imagine people in this stage. People where basically nothing in their lives isn't original in that moment. They're endlessly creative. They never respond the same to the same stimulus. Every time they respond better and better to the same stimulus. And I mean, it's just this incredible geometric society, see?
But when God's reliable, or his response is reliable, or whatever, or his laws are reliable,
yeah,
is that in a way responding the same to the same stimulus? Do you know what I'm asking?
Right. See, and but is that a creature or a creator? See,
that's
if you you're really fixated on existential deity, if you're really fixated on the Father, if that's all God means to you is God the Father, and that existential deity, you get this very false notion that you should be like him and respond exactly the same to every stimulus, just like a ball drops at the same rate every time you drop it. No, you know, you need to be reminded there's another parent, okay? The mother responds differently every nanosecond to the same stimulus, because mother deity is experiential deity, evolutionary deity. Right? It's never the same.
There'd be no evolution if it was. Yeah. You know, it's supreme.
And then it's like, well, how does the Father fit in? The Father is the source of my potentiality, not my actuality. Right? You know, I'm going to consecrate my will to the perfect will of God the Father. I'm going to consecrate my potential to the perfect potential of God the Father. My potential is going to be changelessly like he gave it to me. Right? And I'm going to actualize that potential in relationship to the other parent. Right, he's my stable foundation. I'm going to build my nature on a rock, a changeless rock, right, of existential deity. Right? I am, okay, but one must do something as well as be something. And that doing is ever-changing. But your foundational beingness is changeless if it's been consecrated like that. Yeah, you can build an ever-changing structure on a changeless foundation.
Dynamic.
Right? There's no way for the ever-changing structure to be stable, dynamically stable, if it's built on sand. You know, Jesus tried to teach us this. Right? He was just trying to teach you the starting point, remember? Right? He's not trying to teach you how to build. He's just trying to teach you what to build on. Build. Don't build on sand. Build on a rock. Build on the changeless fact of existential deity. And so you get the proper foundation. Okay, now you got to get to the other parent, figure out what to build upon that foundation. That's what the fifth epical revelation is about. What you do after you've actually chosen the proper building place.
Right. So then our watchword is I am becoming.
Yeah. So... the fact we've got on this tangent just reminds you of how difficult it is to kind of recognize what it is that you're trying to get out of this book, right? it's not what you suspect it is, right? In general, what you're trying to get out of this book is what almost no human has ever even thought to desire.
Right.
And most humans, you know, their highest desire is to get to the mountaintop.
Yeah. Stay there.
They don't have any desire of transcending the mountaintop. Yeah. Right? You know, the apostles didn't say, Master, now that we've gotten to the mountaintop, let us leap up and come into conformity with the cosmos. No. they just wanted to existentialize, you know, and stay at square zero forever. Yeah. Okay. All right, we won't get very far in this section, but
that was a great segue.
But fortunately, okay, this section is broken up into little blocks of the stages of light and life. So we can maybe do a stage or two here. All right.
Section 4, administrative readjustments. In the successive stages of settled existence, the inhabited worlds make marvelous progress under the wise and sympathetic administration of the volunteer core of the finality. The centers of paradise attainment who have come back to minister to their brethren in the flesh. These finaliters are active in cooperation with the Trinity Teacher Sons, but they do not begin their real participation in world affairs until the Marantia Temple appears on earth.
Just, you know, one little quick thing there. You know, we have those initial coordinating teachers, Trinity Teacher Sons. They hand it off to the core of the finality, who took an oath to the Paradise Trinity, right? Again, you know, the whole, the coordination. What the Trinity Teacher Sons started and are going to continue to help with, the finaliters are going to continue working on ever more universal coordination. They're not only working to make that manifest, you know, in the outer life of the universe of universes, you know, local systems settle in light and life, constellations settle in light and life, etc. But on a given world, you know, to have a greater and greater scope of coordination focalized down onto that one world. So even though the local universe isn't settled in life, light and life, that world has effectively gotten to that level. You know, that means that it, there's a vast scope of the whole that's found a place of residence, a footprint there on that one world. And it takes very high coordinate mind, a finality that's gotten all the way up to the top, to be able to have that big of a, you know, that sense of the big picture to, you know, to a vast enough scope. Okay. But that's their job. And that'll be our job one day as finaliters, to be helping people with this, you know, ever higher levels of coordination, to embody it within you. What was that?
I jokingly said, if there's any worlds left,
I'll
minister to it.
The Almighty Supreme will make sure that the worlds don't go away. They'll be here when we're finally finaliters. Okay, so see, just, you know, I keep stressing that. Remember the context. Universal coordination. That's fundamentally what this is all about. Okay.
Upon the formal inauguration of the planetary ministry of the core of the finality, the majority of the celestial hosts withdraw. But the seraphic guardians of destiny continue their personal ministry to the progressing mortals in light. Indeed, such angels come in ever-increasing numbers throughout the settled ages, since larger and larger groups of human beings, reach the third cosmic circle of coordinate mortal attainment during the planetary lifespan.
See, just, you know, notice how they've mentioned the word coordinate again. Remember, the psychic circles are more technically cosmic levels. Right? So coordinate mortal attainment, see, higher cosmic levels. Right? I mean, just, you know, see, there's different words, you know, that effectively are talking about the same thing, the wholeness. Coordinate, cosmic, truth, wisdom. You noticed in the previous paragraph, the finaliters were helping us progress under the wise, right, see, and sympathetic administration. Sympathetic because even though they're a finaliter, they still possess all the nature that goes all the way down to where we are right now and can relate to us as we are where we are, right? So they're sympathetic. They can be together with our suffering.
Because they were once there.
Because they were once there and didn't burn that bridge. It's still in within them, that nature.
So we'll be that way too.
We'll be that way too. We aren't just something that, we aren't a being that's just a blob at the top, right? We're this incredible rod that, you know, we embody everything from the bottom all the way to the top. That's what a finaliter is.
That's our usefulness.
Yeah? That's why if a child has to be resurrected in the probationary nursery, they can't become a finaliter because they're missing the chunk at the bottom.
Chris, what are the majority of celestial hosts?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that. So, just give you a simple example to make that tangible. For instance, Master Seraphim. Right, they've been on the planet ever since the planetary prince first arrived. You have these, you know, the different cores of Master Seraphim. Right, they leave.
There's plenty of angels coming. It says.
Right, you've got.
But there's still a lot. That leave.
But you just, you know, this is another thing. Remember. When initially our universe is centered around us in our perspective, and so the only angels are guardian angels. One of the first steps the Revelation is trying to get you to do is, okay, the universe isn't centered around you, so there's more angels than just guardian angels. I mean, most angels aren't guardian angels. Most angels are doing all kinds of things you can't even imagine. Right.
Always comes back to me.
Right. This planet has all kinds. I mean, that's one of the amazing things about the Revelation. Just seraphim, let alone other beings, but just seraphim. There's all these different kinds of seraphim doing all kinds of things humans had never imagined. Right. That there are angels here doing. You know, even all the way up to Master Seraphim. Right. So that kind of complex, you know, micromanaging of all the parts, kind of administration. See, all that basically goes away, and the administration is much more just fundamentally holistic, right? You know, you've got the finaliters, you know, and just a few others that coordinate this very holistic ministry. There doesn't need to be all of this micromanagement of all the details because everything, you know, all the loose ends have gotten all cleaned up and everything's together now, and it's much easier to manage it. It requires much fewer beings to manage the system.
Longer high maintenance.
Yep.
Well, there's a degree of transcendence taking place because these earlier beings are higher than us. Are still operating on a plane. They don't necessarily have a large picture of the whole.
Yeah,
they only see a little bit of it.
Yeah. I was going to mention that and got lost in all my other words. But yeah. That's the whole point. That a lot of these administrators that go away, they just don't embody the big picture. They're experts in certain parts. Right. But they, you know, so it's like you know, if you've got an engineering firm, you have all kinds of specialist engineers, but there has to be a system engineer, right? That doesn't get down into all the details, but makes sure that the thing functions as a system, that there's a wholeness to what's going on, you know, and none of those specialist engineers have that awareness. They're lost down in their little part. You know, you literally have specialized Master Seraphim. These Master Seraphim are just about that one part. Right, the angels of nation life, say, you know, nothing else. So they're very part-like ministries, see. Experts at a certain part. I mean, you know, so limited that the progress angels can't even govern themselves. You know, they need another group of angels that's whole job is to govern them, right? Be their checkmates. I mean, see, that's how specialized they are, how part-like they are. That's what they're getting at. You now are functioning in a much more holistic mode. And I've alluded to this many times, but see, here it is in print. The startling statement that Indeed, such angels come in ever-increasing numbers throughout the settled ages, since larger and larger groups of human beings reach the third cosmic circle of coordinate mortal attainment during the planetary lifespan. You're going, 500 years of a nature that's completely beyond my wildest imagination of perfectness.
And they're barely getting to the third
circle. And more getting to the third circler. Oh, my goodness gracious. Right. So, you know, that's a very humbling statement. You know, and you might have wondered, it's like true. When they told you that you had about a quarter that were fusing when as you entered light and life, you know, and you might say, well, yeah, but probably everyone else is a first circler, you know, and it just takes longer for them to do that last step to go from first circler to fusion. No. You know, remember what it said here just a little bit ago. Never fear, but that even such glorified spheres present plenty of evil. Okay, all right. There's not going to be plenty of evil if everyone's a first circler. Okay, so yeah, so it, you know, you still have the full spectrum, and so even when you know what was it? It was by the time a world attains the fourth stage of light and life, more than half of the mortals, you know, are fusing during their mortal life.
Fourth stage,
you know. But again, you know, they're reminding you that doesn't mean that everyone else, that other half, are all first circlers, right? Okay, so that it really gives you a sense again of how slow a process is, how difficult it is to become a complete philosophy, right? You can become a kindred spirit in an instant. Become kindred minds is a very, you know, that's an evolutionary process. Time, it's almost endless time is involved. Self-mastery, you know, is spread out from here to eternity, right? That's an evolutionary process, a temporal process, and even a trans-temporal process, right? Right, so you got to think in those trans-religious terms. You know, religion gives you this false sense that you can just snap your fingers and everything can be there, right? Okay, so yes, wow. Third circle. Getting to the point that Jesus was when he was going around the Mediterranean. Flipping it around that way, it's like, whoa, there's a precocious boy.
Yeah.
He wasn't 450 years old when he was going around the Mediterranean. On a world settled in light and life.
He was a first circler before he was 30.
Right? He was a first circler on Mount Hermon. Yeah.
That's
so, yeah, and that's precocious.
Doable. Right.
It's doable. There's always someone at the leading edge of the tail of the bell curve, right? But, you know, they're talking about the center of the bell curve here, you know. And, okay, there's still a lot of people. All right, let's keep going here.
This is merely the first of the successive administrative adjustments which attend the unfolding of the successive ages of increasingly brilliant attainment on the inhabited worlds as they pass from the first to the seventh stage of settled existence.
And so now they're going to get into, okay, it's basically going to be much more of a top-down sort of administration, you know, wholeness down to parts, rather than parts trying to get themselves up to the whole. But they're still parts, and so that's what they want to explain a little bit here next. Okay, you know, there are parts that remain. How do they kind of rearrange, you know, in this new, very top-down coordination of the influence of the finaliters? Okay.
One, the first stage of light and life. A world in this initial settled stage is being administered by three rulers. A, the planetary sovereign, presently to be advised by a counseling Trinity teacher son, in all probability the chief of the terminal core of such suns to function on the planet. B, the chief of the planetary core of finaliters. C, Adam and Eve, who function jointly as the unifiers of the dual leadership of the Prince Sovereign and the Chief of Finaliters.
Okay, so you have this threefold leadership now, primary rulers. You see that more innately coordinate being, the Trinity Teacher Son, you know, steps in to really engage this top-down coordinate consciousness to the planetary sovereign. The chief of the Corps of Finalers has the coordinate nature, so now you have two that are effectively coordinate elements. And Adam and Eve don't leave; they're still here. But look at that curious thing they just said there. So Adam and Eve, who function jointly as the unifiers, okay, of the dual leadership. So you need to say, okay, why is that? Don't just read that and go, okay, got to remember that, memorize that. No, you won't have to memorize it if you ask yourself why. How can they do that? Okay, well, what are the other two? One is a Lenanadec son that's been elevated all the way now to planetary sovereign, and the other is a Finaliter. One is the downstepped expression of the Father. The other is a being who's taken an oath to the Paradise Trinity, and when you downstep the Paradise Trinity, you have Mother.
Oh, yeah. How about that?
Huh, that's handy. We've got an Adam and an Eve. All right, so Eve is the more intimate interface with the Finaliter. Adam is the more intimate interface with the planetary sovereign. And through the two of them, the two endpoints are linked together.
Give me that one more time.
In a coordinate ministry. Eve identifies more immediately, directly with the Finaliter.
Who's the Trinity?
Most of the Trinity. Because the
Finaliter is consecrated themselves to the Paradise Trinity, the whole. And is now functioning as a downstep expression of that whole in a mother-like mode.
Right.
You know, an individuality of wholeness, right, down in the world, a coordinate ministry. So wow, that really elevates your thought. You know, I mean, I thought they were just, you know, corporeal beings, you know, that made babies.
Right.
No, they've got a very high ability. You know, they've been moving up this whole time, and they're now at a coordinate level that can plug in on the two sides here and serve as the unifiers across that differential between the Trinity Teacher-Sonized planetary sovereign on the one hand and the Finaliter on the other. So that's kind of a cool thing.
So Adam and Eve can see a Finaliter, huh?
There's going to be some logistics to this.
Not normal.
they'll mention here in a little bit. Brilliant evening stars are very important in this interface stuff with the Finaliters. But in terms of just nature, you know, forget about all the technical details of it, right? You know, is it a three prong plug or a two prong plug? I mean, forget about the details, but just see it's, you know, the natures are there, mother to mother, father to father.
It's just interesting to contemplate on Eve and what her strength is, and then what her weakness was. I mean, they're almost the same thing. She got juiced about doing a coordinate thing with Kano,
Right, it's like we're not ready for that level of coordinate phenomena yet. It needs to be methodically part-wise still, you know, before you start thinking that coordinately. No, she wanted to think really coordinately right away.
Yeah. And then she got flattered.
Right, it's just, yeah, see, so you can understand, see. The potential for her to be in this incredible role is a double-edged sword back in those early days. Yep. Okay.
Acting as interpreters for the seraphic guardians and the Finaliters are the exalted and liberated midway creatures. One of the last acts of the Trinity Teacher Sons on their terminal mission is to liberate the midwares of the realm and to promote or restore them to advanced planetary status, assigning them to responsible places in the new administration of the settled sphere. Such changes have already been made in the range of human vision as enable mortals to recognize these heretofore invisible cousins of the early Adamic regime. This is made possible by the final discoveries of physical science in liaison with the enlarged planetary functions of the master physical controllers.
Okay, so we've been jumping ahead to this many times. So here it is finally in front of us. You've got the final discoveries of the physical sciences, plus the master physical controllers are starting to become a much more active phenomenon in the environment relative to the mortals, not just relative to sub-electronic, domain stuff, right? But, they're starting to become a very profound environmental fact, that literally through their presence, you're being aided to be able to visualize some of these lower beings. But only because, you've got the receptors, amped up in ways that we obviously can't even imagine. What is it? How do you have to rearrange the molecules so that somehow there's a better relationship to the energy of a midware? I mean, who knows? But anyway, that's all in place. So, they can't visualize a finaliter, right? They can't do that. We have to have finaliters visualized for us around the mansion worlds and stuff, right? But the lower beings. Right? So in other words, they're like Adam and Eve. They could see all those lower beings, the angels, and whatnot. Yeah.
And we're talking about secondary midwares. What about the first? What about the primary midwares?
Well, I mean, again, when they're talking about the midway creatures, you'll notice that it kind of sort of vague. Sometimes they specifically are you can tell they're referring to secondaries. Other times it appears, they must be talking about both here. They're never really specific. And we noticed that back here with the materialized and humanized midway creatures. It's like, is that just the secondaries or is that both? See, I told you that you're seeing, when they say invisible cousins of the early Adamic regime, it's like, okay, that's just secondary. But then you'll see there, no. So it's a little vague. They may not be allowed to lay this all out specifically. That's what it seems to suggest to me because it's so vague. So you've got these. You've got the midwares being able to serve as interpreters. Now. Like I said, there may be really an evening stars involved here and stuff, but just setting all the mechanics aside, just basically remember the finaliter has this nature that goes all the way down. They can see us as we are, even though we can't see them.
Yikes.
Okay. There is that potential for there to be a very eye level, if you will, interface with a midware, okay, and then the midware can be a final interpreting link, especially a secondary, because they actually have adjutant mind, sixth and seventh adjutants, right? To interface more directly with our adjutant mind, they're kind of giving us the stuff that we can understand a bit, where if you can kind of get it down to the level of the midware can do the final translation over to our adjutant mind, and communicate a form that conforms with adjutant mind. The finaliter doesn't have adjutant mind, right? I mean, there's no directness there. So and that's why they can see us but we can't see them, right? I mean, So they're giving you little hints like that. you know, you got the promoter restore, you know, reminding you that, you know, our world of midwares are in kind of an oddball state because of the rebellion and the default, you know, and that's not uncommon, that there may need to be some kind of really sort of officially putting all that behind, and then they're put into responsible places in the new administration. Let's see, anything else there? No, let's get some more here about the midway creatures.
The system sovereign has authority to release midway creatures any time after the first settled stage, so that they may humanize in the Marantia by the aid of the life carriers and the physical controllers, and after receiving thought adjusters, start out on their paradise ascension.
Okay, so I told you there was going to be another little thing about it. See, so it's still humanizing again. So they're taking him from this, you know, basically stationary sun-like sort of a mode, and giving him an upward nature. But they're not humanizing him in the material. They're humanizing him directly in the Marantia. And you know, and that, you know, again, you've got these midwares that they aren't material or morontial, you know, they're, but there's something a little bit transmaterial, you know, for which for us means morontial. So, you know, obviously you could just go that direction with their nature, kind of take it a little bit more horizontally and just make it the parallel Marantia energy form, you know, that's upwardly oriented, rather than kind of leveraging off the foundational aspect of their energy nature and just focusing on that and materializing them. Okay. So they're basically going to make them kind of like an ascending one-time material mortal on the mansion worlds, right? Yeah, as a Marantia ascender. Okay, so humanized in the Marantia. You know, apparently the life carriers and the physical controllers know how to do that.
On a normal planet, there'd be a far higher number of these than on our planet.
Right. Yeah, I mean, especially, you know, some planets have a, you know, even if we hadn't lost any secondary midwares, remember, some planets have lots of secondary midwares, you know, whereas we only had a handful to begin with. Yep. So there's all those issues are in play. You know, you can see the system sovereign. You know, he is really functioning in this very executive sort of a mode. And whether or not to release them or not. But even if they aren't released, like they said in the previous paragraph, you know, you've now brought the two cultures really together. Right? Until Light and Life in general, you have these two parallel cultures, the culture of the midwares and the culture of the humans. Even though they might be aware of each other, they're not really directly, you know, interacting until Light and Life. And then you just, you know, melt it all together into one coordinate culture. You know, and the thing you can speculate, see, is, well, we've got a number of things that are happening kind of ahead of themselves officially on this planet. Michael coming, you know, Mistol's son before, a magisterial son, etc. Is this one of the things they might do here too? Maybe they're going to bring the culture of the midwares together with the human culture way before Light and Life on our planet. Wow. And maybe that's one of the ways that we overcome the fact that we, you know, don't have the kind of guidance that Adam and Eve would be giving us and stuff. You know, and the prince's staff. So you can speculate about that. Anything that is definitely going to happen at some point, you could imagine happening ahead of time if you're that kind of a world. Okay.
We are that.
So that's a possibility for our planet. All right. I love those expressions like humanizing the Marantia. Well, that's not abstract or anything, but you can tell the way they say it. It's a definitive physics, right? You know, it's just like trinitization is a physics, right? Yeah. So, anyway, yeah. We have just enough time for doing this last paragraph here.
In the third and subsequent stages, some of the midwares are still functioning, chiefly as contact personalities for the phenolators. But as each stage of light and life is entered, new orders of liaison ministers largely replace the midwares. Very few of them ever remain beyond the fourth stage of light. The seventh stage will witness the coming of the first Absonite ministers from paradise to serve in the places of certain universe creatures.
Okay.
What is that?
And before we look at those, one thing I wanted to mention, I forgot. Okay, so again, you know, it's in the Marantia, but it's still humanized, which means they get an adjuster.
Right.
Now, of course, you know, unlike those ones that were materialized and humanized, got an adjuster, okay, you know, they're going to fuse and they're, you know, their mortal self is going to be vaporized, and okay, but these that are humanized in the Marantia, all right, then it's just like you're on the mansion worlds, you know, and there's no massive explosion when you fuse, right? You just fuse.
No temples up there.
Right. So if they're contact personalities and finalitors, they must be able to...
Right, see, again, we don't know the mechanics, see, of the contact. See, that's the problem, right? I mean, they just say that, but exactly technically... Right, remember the only way that, you know, the contact personality that was used for the revelation, for instance, you know, that's, you know, leveraging off the adjuster. The mechanics is not being explained here. But nonetheless, we know what we know about it, that they are being used as that, as part of the conduit. Let's see. Okay, so... Then they throw in some real zingers.
Yes, they do.
Okay, so even though they, you know, the midwares can start leaving very early on, they can stay on for a long time. They say, but as each stage of light and life is entered, new orders of liaison ministers largely replace the midwares. So all kinds of beings they haven't revealed start showing up on the planet. Like I said, there's going to be just, the farther we get into light and life, most of the beings that are on the planet are beings that are not revealed in the revelation. Right? So there's less and less they can even tell us about what's there, because it's just, you know, they can't even say so-and-so is there now, because they, you know, they're not allowed to say, talk about so-and-so. And here you're already seeing it, pointing out that there's these beings they haven't even revealed that are able to be down there doing kind of midware-like things. See, who are these beings? Who knows?
Replacements.
Right. But in terms of them, you know, staying on, see, very few remain beyond the fourth stage. Yeah, so, but it doesn't say none. And there's always exceptions to the basic rule. And then the super zinger, the seventh stage will witness the coming of the first Absonite ministers. See, so again, you know, you thought it was very confusing. It's like, well, how are they contact personalities? Exactly how is this working? Okay, what's the mechanics of this? How can you have Absonite ministers that are of any consequence to the mortals on the planet? How does the interfacing work there? But, you know, you got a lot of, you know, profound things are going on. Remember, you've got the unqualified supervisors of the Supreme, you know, that are getting involved in things, you know, and those are basically like, you know, deputy supreme being gods.
Where do the Absonite ministers come from? Are they
from paradise.
Paradise.
You know, the only place you have Absonite beings is on paradise right now, you know, basically, well, in the central universe too, but, but Absonite beings, you know, that's like, Master Architects are Absonite beings, right? I mean, you're talking Absonite beings here.
Almost like a whole new dimension.
Obviously unrevealed.
And then they throw that sentence out right there.
But the physics of it, right? I mean, it's just, like, what on earth are they doing?
On earth.
You're left to wonder, I mean, is there some sort of a subtle interface with the finaliters, and that modifies the finaliter ministry? I mean, who knows? You can just speculate endlessly. But pretty profound stuff. So you know, the fact that you're a long ways away from the grand universe being settled in light and life, where literally the finite domain is right up there, butted up against the bottom of the absentite, and you could imagine something across the boundary. Mm-hmm. Right? But no, a single world, you know, way ahead of that can be up there, you know, and, you know, so the interface is brought down to them, right? You know, in a sense. Like I said, there's, that's, you know, that's the job of the Supreme Being, to have created phenomena like the unqualified supervisors, right, that are, can penetrate down, you know, bring the transcendent down into play in some way that we don't understand. Working with the finaliters and the finaliters, the Trinity Teacher Sons, and the Brilliant Evening Stars. Okay.
I get a sense that at some point science kind of matures to this level that's complete, relatively complete.
Yeah.
And so kind of us can assume that religion might do have a similar parallel phenomenon to that, whatever it is.
Right.
And then, so everything becomes philosophy and the superadditive above what we can see, you know, uh-huh. directly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, when they talk about the final discoveries of physical science, remember, the only way you can make the final discoveries of physical science is basically if that science is not just about matter, but matter, mind, and spirit, right? I mean, you know, to get the final discoveries, you're going to have to get into a science that involves all three energies, right? So it's like you're saying, see, you've really started to transcend science and religion as we currently think of them, where religion is on the spirit substance end and science is on the matter end, and right, you know, and a rudimentary bottom-up human philosophy is working with the mind in between the matter and the spirit. No, we're way transcendent of all that. And
yet these people on this planet are still people.
Yeah.
They're still flesh and blood.
They're still flesh and blood. They get boo-boos when they're little, and and need a Band-Aid.
And when they die, they could go straight to Salvington.
Right? Yeah, they fuse and go right straight to Salvington, and So
the scheme's pretty amazing.
It's pretty mind-boggling to think about. Well, what is a science that can take into account spirit substance just as definitively as it does matter? Right? All the physics of spirit substance and but, you know, you definitely have a motivation. You've got a Morantia temple right there, you know. I mean, you're going to be curious about the physics of Morantia substance when you've actually got a Morantia temple. Yeah, so, right, I mean, so right, they're developing this whole physics that really is about all the threefold, the triune energy system. You know, and so, you know, in that context, it's easier to understand, oh, that maybe is how you can, you know, get it so that we can see. Because, you know, you're working in the triunity, not just with matter. You know, it's a science of the triunity. Yeah. So, okay. All right, well, we'll get to the second stage here next time. As you flip forward, you'll see that they give us a reasonable chunk, but then it starts to get pretty lean, like I said, you know, as you get to the later stages, because, yeah, it literally is the case that you can't. Most of the beings they can't talk about, right? So that's what you know. That's one of the main reasons why there's almost nothing they can say about those later stages. It just is, you know, there's nothing that they can work with even rudimentarily. So they just give you tiny little snippets. But as we get into those, we'll pick up on this whole bit about God the Sevenfold. They gave us one clue, right? About how we can think about these stages beyond what they have any way to talk about directly. All right, so we'll get to that. All right, let's take a moment here, everyone.